Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we are honored to have with us now, right out of the gate this morning, the United States Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy. Just this morning, Dr. Murthy released a Surgeon General's advisory on the growing concerns about social media on young people's mental health. Now, as a kind of spoiler alert, he does not conclude that social media is all bad for America's youth. He sees some good in it in some cases, but he does conclude that our children have become unknowing participants in a decades-long experiment by social media companies to see what the effects actually are, and it's not okay to just let that go on as is. So let's start there with U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. Dr. Murthy, it's always good to have you on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, it's so good to be back, Brian. I hope you've been well.
Thank you very much, and same to you. Now, the first thing your press release on the new advisory addresses is just how pervasive social media use is among American children in the U.S. now, and not just among teenagers, but children as young as 8 years old. Can you lay some of that out for us?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I'll tell you, I come at this issue of social media use and youth mental health, not just as Surgeon General or as a doctor, but as a father of two young kids who are growing up quickly and who are starting to ask about social media, even though my daughter is only 5 years old. So this has become nearly universal. 95% of teens are using social media. Two-thirds of them are using it daily. One-third say that they're using it constantly. That's an extraordinary number. But the reason that this is, what's also important here is how much they're using it. So on average, teens are using social media for 3.5 hours a day. The reason that number matters so much is because we see in the data that when teens use social media for more than 3 hours a day, they face double the risk of depression and anxiety symptoms. And again, the average is 3.5 hours. So we lay out in my advisory a number of areas that we're concerned about where the data is pointing toward harmful effects.
Although rather than just say this is damaging, you say we don't have enough evidence yet to conclude whether the current patterns of social media use are safe.
Well, so what we do with other products that kids use, like car seats, baby formula, medications, even cars, think about a 15 or 16-year-old about to start driving, is we put safety standards in place so that we know that these products are safe. And what we say in the advisory is, having looked at all of the evidence that is publicly available and talk to subject matter experts, we cannot, in fact, conclude at this point that social media is sufficiently safe for our kids. What we do have instead is growing evidence that social media use is associated with harms. There is more data, certainly, we need. That data has not been made available to independent researchers, they tell me, by the technology companies and to the fullest extent that it needs to be. But we know enough now to take action to protect our kids. And that's what I call for in this advisory. We can't afford to wait years more to continue to gather more data. We know enough now to know that there isn't the safety evidence that we need. And that means we've got to take steps to establish safety standards and actually implement and enforce them.
Something you just said, should that be one of the biggest headlines we take away from your advisory, that social media companies have data that they're not sharing with the public on harms to children?
Well, what we hear from researchers all the time, all across the country, is that they aren't getting all the data that they need from social media companies to fully assess the impact of social media on kids. That data may tell us that the harms are greater than what we're currently seeing the available data. It may tell us that there are certain kids who are more at risk. Understanding this is critical so that we can target our interventions appropriately. And look, as a parent, I don't want to ever encounter a situation where I feel like there's information that's being hid from me or that's not being disclosed when it pertains to the health and well-being of my child. And I think every parent has a right to know this information. And I also think they should be able to rely on independent researchers to assess that data and tell them whether or not their child is at risk.
Now, I mentioned in the intro that your advisory does not say social media is all bad for teens and even younger children. You note some specific risks, like we've been talking about already, but also some specific benefits that social media use can have. For example, I'm reading from your press release here, 7 out of 10 adolescent girls of color report encountering positive or identity-affirming content related to race across social media platforms at least monthly. Number two, a majority of adolescents report that social media helps them feel more accepted, 58%, like they have people who can support them through tough times. And social media can serve as a source of connection, information, and support for youth who are often marginalized, such as the LGBTQ plus community and people with disabilities. So that's a lot. And that's not the kind of thing we usually hear in media discussions of social media. Do you want to elaborate on any of those?
Well, absolutely. Well, the data does tell us that social media can have mixed benefits and risks for kids. Like some kids do find that they can connect more easily with family and friends and have a place and a forum to express themselves creatively on social media and to find a community that they may not otherwise find in person. And all of that is very important. But we also have to balance that against the risks that have begun to emerge in the data, risks around the depression and anxiety symptoms, but also risk related to body image. Nearly half of adolescents are saying that using social media makes them feel worse about their bodies. And then consider that for a moment. We're living in a time when eating disorders, where poor self-esteem are profound challenges for so many youth. And I, like all parents, want my kids to grow up with confidence, feeling good about themselves, and set up to really thrive and succeed. But for too many kids, that is not the experience they have on social media. Let me just give you an analogy as well, Brian, which is if we had a medication that was very effective, let's say, at treating infections, but it also, it turned out, had side effects and had terrible effects on your kidney and your liver, we would say, gosh, we're not necessarily, we don't know if that should be made available to people. If those risks are significant, we should either study that more or change that medication or put safeguards in place so that people are protected against that downside harm. We have to think about this similarly, which is that the goal should be to maximize the benefits of social media while minimizing the harms. But to do that, we've got to take an intentional approach. We've got to establish actual safety standards like we do for other products that kids use. And that doesn't exist right now. Even the age limitations that companies have put in place, where they say you have to be 13 years or older to use many of these platforms, even those are not well enforced because 40% of kids 8 through 12 are on social media.
Concerns about media exposure, as I'm sure you know, go back to the printing press. Media critics of Gutenberg's era said people would become disconnected from each other because they'd be in their own worlds reading books. We know that television used to be a concern over mindless passivity. Maybe it still is, but we don't talk about it that much anymore. Now kids simply watching TV, some people see that as the good old days. So is today's concern different in kind?
I'm really glad you asked that question, Brian, because you're right. Whenever there's major change, often introduced by different modern technologies, sometimes people get worried about what they're losing as a result of that. But there's something fundamentally different, I believe, about what's happening with social media. It has transformed our lives in a much more profound way than television did, and then other recent developments in technology. If you think about it this way, social media has fundamentally changed how kids see themselves, how they interact with each other, and how they perceive the world. It's also rapidly evolving technology, and is so much so that for many parents, it's incredibly difficult to keep up with this technology, much less monitor it and manage it for your children. And it's also pervasive. When I was growing up, if I wanted to turn off the information environment around me, I got up and I turned off the TV. But for a child now growing up, it's coming at them 24/7, information, posts, and other content on social media. And much of that content for so many kids is not positive. Too many of our kids are exposed to violence and sexual content online, to bullying and harassment. This is a real profound challenge that takes a toll on the mental health and well-being of kids. And finally, just keep in mind, we are living through perhaps the worst youth mental health crisis in recent memory. And we've got to look under every stone, if you will, to understand what the causes and drivers may be and to address them. And I believe when I talk to parents and kids around the country and I look at the data that we have, that social media is likely to be one of the key drivers here. And that's why we've got to act quickly. This isn't about, you know, getting rid of social media altogether, you know, for everybody. This is about making sure that we're thoughtful and intentional about protecting our kids from the harms and ensuring that they can reap the benefits.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we have a few more minutes with the United States Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, who just this morning has released a Surgeon General's advisory on the growing concerns about social media on young people's mental health. And I want to let people know, because I've been reading your other material from recently, that this advisory is in the context of a larger project that you've undertaken to fight what you call a loneliness epidemic in the United States. Can you give us some of the big picture on that as it relates to this?
Oh, that's such, I'm glad you brought that up, Brian, because this is a concern I've had for a long time, but it's been growing, which is that I do believe, sadly, we are experiencing an epidemic of loneliness and isolation in America. And it's not just America, many other countries are experiencing this as well. One in two adults in America report measurable levels of loneliness. And the numbers, it turns out, are even greater among young people. And this matters so much, Brian, because we now understand something we perhaps didn't 10, 15 years ago, which is that social disconnection, when you're lonely and you're isolated, that is actually associated with not only worse mental health outcomes, like depression, anxiety, and suicide, but also with worse physical health outcomes, including cardiovascular disease, premature death, and dementia and stroke. So the bottom line is that our connection to one another is not just a nice to have. Our relationships are vital for our survival. And when we are disconnected with one another, it is not only bad for our individual health, but it affects societal health as well. It turns out that when communities are more connected, they are more economically prosperous, they tend to have less violence, and they're more resilient in the face of adversity, like hurricanes and tornadoes. But too many people are feeling disconnected. Too many communities have actually broken down over the years, because in the last half century, we've seen a decline in participation in faith organizations and recreational leagues and so many of the groups that brought us together. Social media ultimately was, I believe, created, in the hopes of building community and bringing people together. And while some people have found that, far too many people have found that what used to be higher quality in-person interactions have been replaced with lower quality online interactions. And there's nothing to replace in-person connection. All of us need that.
How much do you think the pandemic isolation intersected with the good and bad of social media?
Well, that's important. The pandemic, for many people, worsened their sense of isolation and loneliness, although that was a trend that was building for many years prior to the pandemic. I would say the pandemic poured fuel on a fire that was already burning. But when it comes to social media use during the pandemic, look, for many children, turning to social media was helpful to them during the early days of the pandemic when they weren't able to be in school, because it kept them connected with friends and with family members. And that was positive. But we also know that when I talk to young people around the country about being back in school and what their life is like now, many of them say that they still feel like they're trying to rebuild their social skills and rebuild their connections to one another. And to do that, it's very important that we protect in-person, face-to-face time. If we are primarily interacting with people online, again, it is just not the same. We don't build the same types of relationships. So while social media, again, can be mixed in terms of benefits and harms, our goal really should be to make sure that it's a tool that kids can use safely, that parents know they're supported on in terms of helping manage their use, by their kids. And I'll just tell you right now, Brian, just so many parents feel alone in managing this challenge. They feel like the entire burden of managing social media, as rapidly evolving and changing as it is, has been placed on their shoulders. And this is time we've got to step up and have their backs. And that's why I'm calling for so many of the changes and actions from policymakers and technology companies that I am in this advisory.
And we'll close in a minute on the specific changes that you are calling for. But do you, as a public health leader, have any regrets over how much school or other aspects of kids' in-person social contact was shut down in the name of protecting people from the virus? In hindsight, was it to any degree a well-intentioned overreaction that may be resulting in public health, mental health in particular, outcomes maybe not as bad as what we were all trying to prevent, which was mass death, but worse than you would have anticipated?
Yeah, this is an important question because we have to always look back on what happened after emergency responses and ask, did we make the right decisions or not? And what can we learn for the future? There will likely be some pandemic at some point down the line. We need to take the lessons of today and apply it to that. Look, when the pandemic began, when schools were being shut down during that first year of the pandemic, you know, I, like many Americans out there, was watching as a parent. You know, I was a private citizen at that time. I was watching what was happening, and I was worried for our country. But I understood that the public health leaders in government at that time, and even though I wasn't part of government and talking to them, my understanding is that they were likely making the best decisions they could with very limited information. If we knew then what we know now, I suspect that we would not have closed down schools, you know, as long as we did, perhaps, or as long as those who were in government did at that time. But I also recognize that they were operating with very limited information. So, you know, I think we should give them some grace with that and recognize what they were trying to do was really protect our kids. But what was really important was to get our kids back to school as soon as possible. You know, when President Biden took office, I remember one of the things that that he and I had talked about, in fact, even before he assumed office, was the importance of getting kids back to school. It was a top priority when he started. And 42% or so of kids were in school in person. You know, when 2021 began, that number was closer to 99% by the fall of 2021. And that was the right move to get kids back to school. Yeah. So the bottom line is that we've got to deal with the ongoing fallout that you know, our kids and frankly the broader population is dealing with from COVID-19. It's not just from the shifts in school, but keep in mind that many kids lost loved ones. 160,000 plus kids lost caregivers during the pandemic. Many of them saw people they care about get sick and their lives were turned upside down. And they're still struggling to get back a sense of stability and normalcy. That's why youth mental health is such an important issue for us to address. It's why it will continue to be the key priority that I hold as Surgeon General. And it's why issues like social media are critical, because they deeply affect the mental health of our youth.
Right. And of course, the closures were not just to protect the kids, but also to protect the teachers, the parents, and the grandparents who were more at risk from serious disease. But all right, you say the burden cannot simply fall to parents and children as individuals to control the negative effects of social media. So what institutions, government or corporate, should do what?
So if we think about technology companies, where they can really play an important role here is, number one, in designing their platforms in ways that prioritize the safety and well-being of users. You know, many of the platforms are designed to maximize time spent. As Surgeon General, what I care about is the health and well-being of our kids on these platforms. And that's what we should be seeking to maximize. Technology companies can also, though, be more transparent with the data that they have that's related to health impacts, so that independent researchers can assess this and help parents understand the full impact of these platforms on their children. But this can't be left up to technology companies alone. And that's why I lay out a number of steps that policymakers have to take as well. We need our lawmakers to establish safety standards to protect kids from harmful content, to also ensure that they're protected against features that would seek to manipulate them to spend excessive, unhealthy amounts of time on these platforms. And we should also have standards that protect the privacy and the identity of users. You know, keep in mind, 6 in 10 adolescent girls have been contacted by a stranger on social media in ways that made them feel uncomfortable. We've got to be better to actually protect, you know, our kids from that kind of contact. And finally, you know, policymakers can require the kind of data sharing and transparency that researchers say we have been lacking for far too long. You know, policymakers are important here because it's not just in setting standards, but it's actually in enforcing them. And the very limited rules that we've had so far just have not been adequately enforced, in my mind. As a parent, what I want to know is that not only are there standards in place, but that as a parent that I'm understanding transparently what the data is telling me, how it's evolving around the risks and benefits to my kids. We owe it to parents to provide them that. And again, Brian, I say this as a parent myself, you know, like I've got a 5 and 6 year old, and my 5 year old daughter came home a couple of weeks ago, and she asked my wife and I if she could post a picture on social media. We were stunned. She's in preschool. We haven't talked to her about social media. Clearly, she doesn't have a social media account, and she won't for a while. But this has become ubiquitous. Kids see and encounter social media everywhere. They're thinking about it and talking about it. So we can't wait to take these steps that I've outlined to make sure that these platforms are safer and to put in place the kind of guardrails around, you know, age restrictions and safety restrictions that these platforms have needed for a long, long time.
The next generation's first words, mama, dada, and TikTok. So we will see if policymakers run with your advisory that you're releasing this morning on not just standards, but enforcement of those standards. I hear you on that point for social media companies, given the risks to youth in the United States. Listeners, we've been hearing from the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, who released a Surgeon General's advisory this morning on the growing concerns about social media on young people's mental health. Thank you so much for making this one of your very first stops to share it with the American people. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Brian. I'm so glad to talk about this. And just for everyone to keep in mind, our kids are at a very sensitive time of development, specifically brain development. And what they're exposed to really matters during those years. So every year for our children count. It's why I'm so focused on making sure that these platforms are safe for our kids.
Thanks, Dr. Murthy. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and happy 140th birthday to the Brooklyn Bridge. It opened that many years ago today, May 24th, 1883. A mere 42 years ago, filmmaker Ken Burns first made his mark with his documentary about the bridge, and he has just released this morning a new 10-minute short of himself and New York Times architecture critic Michael Kimmelman walking across the bridge and discussing the bridge together. They also ate at the River Cafe just below the bridge as Ken looks up with reverence.
This is one of my favorite spots on Earth. Yeah. I remember David McCullough said in our film that it was like standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon. And I think there are people who go, huh, what, Brooklyn Bridge? Yeah. And yet, when you think that those two towers were the tallest man-made objects in all of North America, that what it must have been like to live in a Manhattan and a Brooklyn of nothing more than 4 or 5 stories, to suddenly having this thing soaring above you.
That little excerpt from the new Ken Burns short about walking the bridge with Michael Kimmelman, which you can see on Ken Burns' PBS page called Unum, or on James Barron's New York Times newsletter called New York Today. And with me now are documentary filmmaker Ken Burns and Michael Kimmelman, architecture critic for the New York Times and author of the book that came out last year, The Intimate City, Walking New York. Ken and Michael, what a treat to have you on together. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Ken, just in that little clip I pulled of you looking up from the River Cafe, I learned something. The Brooklyn Bridge arches were once the tallest things in New York City?
In North America, man-made objects in North America. So you just can imagine what it must have been like to have seagulls fly beneath your feet, big, tall, masted ships, you know, walking under you. And this is a bridge, unlike any other bridge on Earth, that privileges the walker, right? It's elevated. It's still wood slats. It's a kind of wonderful New York thoroughfare, a public space between these Gothic towers and compression, the granite of that, and the steel, this new metal that the Civil War had just promoted the use of, intention in the beautiful spider web-like design that made it sturdier, but also made it not just this practical utilitarian invention, but a work of art, and one of the most important works of art, American works of art, in the 19th century, as well as I don't think there's an argument, the greatest engineering feat in America in the 19th century. So lots to celebrate today on its 140th birthday.
And Michael, Ken just mentioned the walkers. I mean, if the Brooklyn Bridge opened 140 years ago today, that was before there were even cars and before Brooklyn was even part of New York City. So what was the traffic like in the bridge used for originally?
Yeah, well, actually, that's funny. You're absolutely right. There was the first carriage was driven across it, a horse-drawn carriage by Emily Roebling, as Ken pointed out in the original film, carrying, what was it, Ken, a rooster?
A rooster, which was a symbol of victory. She had taken over when her husband was stricken with the bends and confined to his Brooklyn Heights bedroom and watching the
That's the architect of the bridge, John Roebling, right?
John Roebling died. The architect died in the first months of construction. His foot was crushed accidentally by a ferry coming in as they were surveying. And his young son, Washington Roebling, 32 years old, took over. And when he was incapacitated by the bends, his heretofore Victorian wife, Emily Roebling, took over and became his eyes and ears and good right arm and was able to convey his wishes to the bridge. You know, it's funny you brought up, you know, Brooklyn wasn't part of New York. The bridge makes it part of New York. Walt Whitman said, "Lo, soul, seest thou not God's purpose from the first? The earth be spanned, connected by networks, the lands be welded together." And in fact, it is the fact that there is a now perfect way and a beautiful way to get between these two cities. One is a bedroom community, a city of churches, Brooklyn, to the center of commerce and manufacturing in all of the United States, Manhattan. And it's going to essentially prompt the welding of the lands together into the five boroughs.
I want to play for our listeners the one clip in this 10-minute short that isn't of you two talking. And talk about a guest star. It's the playwright Arthur Miller making this comparison with a bridge that I guess was already there.
I mean, they could have built another Manhattan Bridge, couldn't they? And he didn't. He really aspired to do something gorgeous. So, makes you feel that maybe you too could add something that would last and be beautiful.
Ken, I hate to ask you to correct the historical memory of Arthur Miller, but which came first, the Manhattan Bridge or the Brooklyn?
The Brooklyn Bridge, by far. But what he's talking about is in a timeless sense that there was a kind of, not just utilitarianism, there's a kind of boring aspect to the Manhattan Bridge. It doesn't have the kind of poetic beauty that it does. I mean, look, any bridge is something. I mean, a log across a stream gets my heart racing just a little bit, you know, just the excitement of it, the little boy in me. What he's doing, he's challenging us. And he says to us at the beginning, it's the only interview I've ever conducted in which I used every single bit of it. It was like 40 seconds. And he says, "You see, the city is fundamentally a practical utilitarian invention. And suddenly you see this steel poetry standing there." And it's a wonderful thing that he's relating this public work, this civic engagement that has an artistic side to it, and then also maybe something larger for you intimately that it might prompt you to add something that would last and be beautiful. And that's the last word of my film. It's sort of like, I felt like the young and idealistic Charles Foster Kane, you know, nailing up his precepts to Joseph Cotton as he first gets into the newspaper business before he's corrupted, that this is our obligation as human beings in some way. Maybe it's a garden, maybe it's a child raised with love, maybe it's a symphony, maybe it's a cure for disease, maybe it's a bridge.
And listeners, if you're just joining us, we have a few more minutes with the filmmaker Ken Burns and New York Times architecture critic Michael Kimmelman. There's a new Ken Burns short out today, about 10 minutes long, featuring the two of them, mostly walking across the Brooklyn Bridge to observe what today is. It's the 140th birthday of the Brooklyn Bridge. And Michael, I think it was you who said in the film that there was something about the architect Roebling that was like the bridge. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, Roebling, John Roebling was a remarkable character, a towering figure in the history of engineering. He was German. He came to the United States partly as a religious dream. He came and settled in Pennsylvania into a kind of utopian village, did not see that as his future, saw his future in both business. He invented the steel cables. And also in sort of, you know, changing the nature of engineering. So you see those aspects in the bridge, too, that there's this sort of aspirational quality to the bridge, the dream of an America that's something really great and uplifting. I mean, you know, the idea, as Ken said earlier, that he wasn't just building something that spanned the water, but these great Gothic towers are quite literal references to the Gothic cathedrals that are, you know, the most enduring works of architecture and really engineering we've ever built. And the scale of it, the sense of monumentality and the eternal nature of the Gothic towers in harmony, as Ken said, with these advances in engineering. This was an enormous feat, this great span of the bridge. And the beauty of the bridge is also that it works, you know, on all of these different levels together. You know, it is both this image of the unification of New York, of something raised above the city and to which we aspire. But when you're walking across it, you know, the beauty of the bridge is you feel those steel slats on the pedestrian walkway. They're soft and tangible. And then the ways in which the stays and cables interact is very much about engineering, but it creates sort of like the letting of stained glass when you walk through, you know, past it and look through that. So it's in harmony even with the Gothic towers. There's something so exquisite and finished about the bridge. And I think that's what Miller was getting at too. You know, the bridge is something we dream of. It's a something that symbolizes New York as a place of dreams.
Yeah, and that symbolizes New York, Ken. Again, lingering on that Arthur Miller quote for just another minute, his line that the bridge made other people think they could do something great too. That is so New York, right?
So New York, and that's exactly right. And we can't imagine, you know, that is how the film ends. How it begins is in a similar thing, the Harper's Weekly, which was the leading illustrated magazine of the time on the 24th or thereabouts of 1883 when the bridge opened. It says, it so happens, and this is how we start the film, it so happens that the work which is likely to be our most durable monument and to convey some knowledge of us to the most remote posterity is a work of bare utility, not a shrine, not a fortress, not a palace, but a bridge. This is a new democratic paradigm. We are not subservient to some monarch. We are not in a warlike posture. We are not subscribing to one religion. We are going to find our catechism in civic works, in civic ideals, and in what that suggests about democratic unity. And of course, the history of New York is the ebbing and flowing of all of those energies, the dissipation of that and the sad times, and the bridge is always there to offer, as Lewis Mumford told us, that he experienced as a young man in the 1920s, a kind of transcendental experience that Hart Crane wrote about in a magnificent poem, that Walker Evans photographed, that we have as kind of this, not just for New York, but I think for the whole country, this extraordinary biographical drama of how it got made. And then overlying, you know, this is not, you know, simpler times. Boss Tweed has got his hands in it. There's wire fraud and all sorts of intrigues and the death of people from Caisson's disease, which is what we call the bends. All the drama of it is there. And yet at the heart, the residue that still remains in those stained glass panels ever shifting that Michael's talking about. To me, in some ways, it looks like music and staff and writing and the seagulls become the notes that play the tunes, the music of the bridge, not just the hum, the thrum of the traffic below, but the music of it has the possibility to work on us in a way that hopefully we're conscious of, but maybe not. And I walk the bridge almost every day that I'm in New York, and I have now people that I recognize and see, and they nod. And there's that kind of community that you get in a small town that I actually do live in, there on the bridge in our public space.
Yeah. So let's finish, as we start to run out of time, on this idea of walking the bridge, which the two of you talk about so beautifully in the 10-minute short. We'll let the listeners go to it and see most of that for themselves. But Michael, I've had the great pleasure of walking across the Brooklyn Bridge, bicycling across the Brooklyn Bridge, running it in some big group 5K races, which is so exhilarating with that community and the views in both directions. But for you as an architecture critic, it also occurs to me that there are, of course, other bridges around here that you can walk or ride, but I'm disappointed in both the Tappan Zee or Mario Cuomo Bridge renovation and what they're doing with the George Washington, because bikes and pedestrians have to share these pretty narrow side lanes where you have to be aware so riders don't crash into walkers. And the Brooklyn Bridge is just so special for that centering of the people. So can you talk about that as we finish up?
Yes, well, you nailed it, Brian. That's exactly right. I mean, from the very beginning, Roebling put the pedestrian walkers not just at the center, but over the other traffic, which was in the beginning everything from cattle to carriages, because there is about this the sort of centrality of man walking, sort of every man. It's a bridge for every man. You're absolutely right. All the other bridges, and New York has some extraordinary bridges. I mean, you know, the George Washington Bridge is also a gorgeous, amazing thing. The Verrazano, these are also feats of engineering. But the Brooklyn Bridge is really a street that connects the two great boroughs. It was from this era of unification, the same era as the Transcontinental Railway and the Transoceanic Cable. And there is something about it as a meeting place. The bridges, the other bridges are really just about moving traffic. But the Brooklyn Bridge is a place where I think it's designed. You reach the top of that very soft arch, and that's where the cables open up, and you have that view, that sense of ownership of the city. I just wanted to say one other thing about that, Brian, because the bridge is aspirational, but it's also a kind of admonition these days. I mean, it's very hard to imagine that we would do something like this, something that's greater than it needed to be. Greater than us and longer lasting. You know, it's so difficult to get anything done today. So when we cross that bridge, when we walk across it, I think there's also that feeling like, could we do this again? What will it take to get us to a place where we're unified enough, or at least ambitious enough, to aspire to something like the Brooklyn Bridge?
Michael Kimmelman, New York Times architecture critic and documentary filmmaker. Ken Burns, you can see them together in the new 10-minute Ken Burns short, celebrating today's 140th birthday of the Brooklyn Bridge. And you can see it on Ken's PBS page, which is called Unum. That's Unum as in E. Pluribus's last name, right, Ken?
You got it. You got it. That's right, exactly right. As Arthur Schlesinger said, there's too much pluribus, not enough unum. We're into unum, and we can't think of a better place to celebrate that than on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Well, thanks for the unum from the duo, both of you. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, stay with us. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Did you know that the Supreme Court can issue decisions without explaining them and without even indicating which justices voted for or against? A new book by University of Texas law professor Stephen Vladeck traces the recent history of what's known as the shadow docket, which conservatives on the court started using more aggressively during the Trump administration to do things like allow Texas's 6-week abortion ban to take effect even before they overturned Roe versus Wade. Maybe you saw Vladeck's op-ed in the New York Times this week called Supreme Court Justices Don't Like Being Criticized in Public, which is a good reason to keep doing it. That's mostly about the shadow docket, too. So we'll talk now about the intersection of today's conservative culture war offensive and the current court and some current news as well. The book's full title is The Shadow Docket: How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. Stephen Vladeck's full title is the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the University of Texas. Professor Vladeck, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be with you.
What's a docket and what's the shadow docket?
So, I mean, the docket, these are both just really descriptive terms that are summarizing, that are encapsulating all of the cases that are before the Supreme Court at any one given time. And so, you know, the Supreme Court decides, 55 or 60, what we might call merits cases each term. We got three of those decisions today. And, you know, Brian, those are the rulings we're used to. Those are the rulings where the justices write lengthy opinions. There might be concurrences. There might be dissents. The shadow docket is basically everything else that the Supreme Court does. It was a term coined by a Chicago law professor, Will Bode, in 2015 as a way of just saying, hey, you know, the merits cases that we pay so much attention to are really only about 1% of the dispositive orders the Supreme Court hands down.
Whoa, maybe 1%.
So maybe we should be looking at the other 99%. Now, I mean, Brian, you know, most of the other 99% is pretty banal. Folks are not going to get exercised about the justices giving a party more time to file a brief or turning away a meritless appeal. But the real sort of shift that the book tries to document and that the book tries to contextualize is how over the last 7 years, we've seen the justices, especially the conservative justices, use this other 99%, the unsigned, unexplained orders, in ways that have had far more significant impacts than ever before. You mentioned the Texas six-week abortion ban, President Biden's vaccination mandate for large employers, the mifepristone case from last month. I mean, you can hardly turn around these days without seeing the Supreme Court doing something pretty significant through unsigned, unexplained orders.
Right. So these are examples of shadow docket cases. Technically, what they are is applications for emergency relief. I guess that's the temporary status of a controversial item while the underlying case makes its way through the court system.
You got, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, so if we think about the typical case taking 3, 4, 5 years to get from when it's filed to a final decision by the Supreme Court, you know, Brian, there's often a dispute over what the status quo should be while that case works its way through, while it gets all the way to the Supreme Court. Should the status quo to be to leave the law that is being challenged in the case on the books and enforceable for the duration of the case? Should it be to block the law for the duration of the case? And, you know, there's a lot of power and there's a lot of policy that exists in those shadows, that exists in how the court responds to those kinds of requests. And Brian, it really was not that common until really 2016, 2017, that you would see the Supreme Court being asked to intervene as often as it's being asked to intervene in ways that are having such statewide or nationwide policy effects.
And to continue to explain just what this is, I mean, they're not taking cases in secret, but they're ruling on them without having to disclose which justices voted for or against or disclose any rationale for these decisions. So I'm curious, why are those the rules rather than have to be transparent about who and why like they do in their regular case decisions?
I mean, I think the short answer is just because of how things evolved. I don't think there was ever a conscious choice by the justices to say we're going to hand down these rulings and not explain ourselves. But, you know, the book really tries to put into context, especially for non-legal readers, how we got here. So as recently as the 1970s, the norm, if you had one of these emergency applications, if you had a party asking the court to step in at an early stage of a case, was that the application would go to the so-called circuit justice, the one of the nine justices who had geographic responsibility for part of the country. So for New York right now, that's Justice Sotomayor. And the circuit justice, Brian, actually usually would provide a fair amount of process and transparency. It was fairly common for circuit justices to have oral arguments in chambers by themselves. They would write opinions by themselves. And this was a helpful balance of, one, giving the parties a meaningful opportunity to be heard and a principled basis for the decision, while two, not doing anything that would be confused as a decision of the full court. And there's this shift in the 1980s that I think is only really now apparent in retrospect, where in response to a flurry of death penalty applications, where you have, you know, folks on death row who are about to be executed, or states challenging lower court rulings that blocked executions, we see the Supreme Court move away from those norms. We see the Supreme Court move toward full court rulings as opposed to individual justices that by tradition are unsigned and unexplained. And, you know, Brian, in the context of the death penalty, I guess that wasn't as controversial because everyone understood that the court wasn't making any law, that however significant an individual case might be, whether a particular death row inmate in Texas or Alabama could be executed didn't really have statewide or nationwide implications. That's the shift in the last 6 or 7 years that I think is why this has become such an important topic for all of us, because now we're seeing almost as a regular matter cases with nationwide implications where the justices are applying the same historical behavior, and where that I think the sort of the norms break down, where the reasons for not providing those justifications are hard to square with why we let the Supreme Court have this authority in the first place.
Do you see the increased use of the shadow docket by the current court as conservative agenda driven?
I think it certainly correlates with the rise of the conservative majority, with the ascendancy of the conservative majority. And I think it does overlap with the conservative agenda in one critical respect, which is that a lot of what's happening in these cases is that the justices are just voting, you know, in the context of whether what should the status quo be for the whole case. They're just voting what they think the ultimate answer should be. And so, you know, if we're going to rule for this party or this state 3 years from now, why don't we just rule for them today? That, I think, is not inherently conservative, Brian, but I think it is an argument that has become more common among the conservative justices, that all that matters is the underlying substantive legal principle. And we can sort of, you know, not be troubled by the pesky procedural checkboxes standing in our way. But I also think, I mean, this, you know, part of the story, I think, is also a little bit complicated on this front. I'm very critical of the current conservative majority, but I don't think it's anything about the fact that they're conservatives that explains this behavior. I think it's actually of a piece with a broader phenomenon that we're also seeing in the ethics space with all of these, you know, stories about Justice Thomas, where the court has just become increasingly unaccountable as an institution, and just sort of increasingly unworried about being reined in by the political branches, unbeholden to public pressure and criticism. And that, to me, again, is not a story about conservatism in general. It's just, if we had a liberal majority right now, I would think the court would be just as unaccountable, and it would just be different people criticizing it.
Oh, interesting. And I want to get into just how much power the Supreme Court should have in your opinion, but let me invite listeners in here, your questions or opinions about the Supreme Court, 212-433-WNYC. You can call or text 212-433-9692, and especially the so-called shadow docket that our guest, University of Texas Law Professor Stephen Vladeck's book is about, all these applications for emergency relief while the underlying cases get argued, which, you know, sounds a little wonky, but we're hearing the big implications it has for abortion rights, for migrants' rights, for public health policy. But we can go broader, too, onto current cases. Professor Vladeck mentioned that the Supreme Court issued 3 decisions this morning. We will touch on them as we go. Or what he's seeing in Texas or other southern states as the culture war rages on abortion rights, trans family rights, migrants' rights, gun rights, and other things, using the courts, among other avenues. 212-433-WNYC. Call or you can text today, 212-433-9692. Let me go right to that question about the amount of power, because the term shadow docket may ring as sinister to Justice Alito, as he has said, and says it's an unfair term because it implies something that isn't real. But your book title goes much further. It says the court is using stealth rulings to amass power and undermine the republic. So accusing the Supreme Court of purposely undermining the republic is pretty strong stuff, Professor Vladek. Does the book back up that title?
I mean, I think so, Brian. I guess readers will have to decide for themselves. But I think that the place where that charge, and I thought a lot about, I mean, that part of the subtitle, because it's provocative. But the place where I think the argument really starts to hit home about how these rulings are undermining the sort of structural relationships that the Constitution creates for our system is in the election cases. So, you know, if we look at the Supreme Court's use of unsigned, unexplained orders in election cases, let's just go back to last year. So last winter in February, the court issued an unsigned, unexplained order in a pair of redistricting cases out of Alabama, where lower courts had both held that Alabama had to redraw its U.S. House districts because of its 7-member congressional delegation. It had only created one so-called majority-minority district, even though the population of the state is 27% Black. And so the lower court said, you know, you need a second majority-minority district. And Brian, I don't think it's speaking out of school to suggest that in a state like Alabama, such a district would almost certainly be a safe Democratic seat, as opposed to a safe Republican seat. Well, the Supreme Court steps in and issues a stay of that ruling that allows Alabama to use its unlawful maps throughout the 2022 midterm cycle. The exact same thing happens a couple of months later in Louisiana, and a couple of other lower courts, one in Georgia, one in Ohio, follow suit and say, well, yes, we actually think these maps are unlawful, but the Supreme Court blocked the rulings of our sister courts in Alabama and Louisiana, so we're not actually going to block these maps ourselves. Brian, you can draw a straight line from those rulings to somewhere between 3 and 6 or 7 House seats. And right there, we're talking about which party controls the House of Representatives in the current Congress.
So are you accusing the Republican-appointed majority on the court of trying to strengthen the Republican majority in the legislative branch?
So I don't think it's quite that conscious. I think the larger point is that if the Supreme Court is going to be intervening in this respect, and if the court is going to be having these effects on our elections, which is not exactly new, the court owes it to us and it owes it to the system to provide an explanation. And that's, Brian, not just me. I mean, the court has said historically over and over again that its legitimacy comes largely from its ability to provide principled justifications for its decision making. Not because you and I and listeners are going to agree with the principles that the justices are espousing in these rulings, but at least hopefully we will agree that they are principles. And when you're missing that in the context of these unsigned, unexplained orders, the fact that those orders have this remarkable tendency to favor Republicans and not favor Democrats really, I think, does get to the charge that the subtitle levels. That, you know, these kinds of rulings, not in their bottom line, but in their lack of rationale and in their inconsistency, really are fundamentally inconsistent with the role the court is supposed to play in our republic.
University of Texas Law Professor Stephen Vladek with us on his new book, The Shadow Docket, How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. And Danny in Massapequa, you're on WNYC with Professor Vladek. Hi, Danny.
Good morning, guys. You know, you point out the Louisiana and the Alabama redistricting, but this has been going on for 200 years. We had an equally ridiculous redistricting process in New York, and I believe the Supreme Court has long tendered that they are not going to get involved in it. It's not their domain. Can you imagine the anarchy if every 10 years the Supreme Court had to get involved with 50 redistricting lawsuits, because everybody sues everybody, and finally you just have to let the state legislators hammer out their own agreement. It can't possibly end up at the Supreme Court. But my main question is, since everything seems to end up in lawsuits these days, is that the real reason why the Supreme Court is issuing so many more rulings or emergency rulings? Because everybody sues. If the Democratic president says something, 14 Republican attorney generals. If the other way around, of course, everybody's suing everybody instead, and in a way to bypass regulations and laws. Let let legislations make laws. I don't think the Supreme Court wants to make laws. I just think they want to define whether they're legal or not. But they're not going to get involved in the actual making of laws. And this is what I think people are looking for.
Danny, thank you. Interesting question. Professor?
I think Danny is absolutely right that there is a broader problem in our system right now, which is congressional dysfunction. And that congressional dysfunction basically requires and enables presidents of either party. I mean, we've seen this from, you know, presidents who are Republicans, we've seen it from presidents who are Democrats. Brian, to innovate when it comes to regulations, to try to govern through executive orders and through, you know, interpretations of statutes that may or may not be correct. And that in turn precipitates all of these legal challenges. So in that respect, I think Dan is absolutely right. The messier part here is when it comes to the total number of cases the Supreme Court's deciding, that number is actually going down. So if we look at the so-called the merits docket, the big fancy cases that get the full 9 yards of process, that get multiple rounds of argument and an opinion, the court is deciding fewer of those today than at any point since the Civil War. This term, the court's going to decide probably about 57 cases that way. It's going to be the fourth year in a row the court didn't get to 60. Before 2019, Brian, the last time the court was that low in total merits rulings was 1864. So, you know, on the merits docket, the court's actually doing less. The question, I think, the tricky thing about Danny's question is, why would the sort of the increase in government by regulation necessarily create more emergencies? And that's where I think the connection maybe breaks down, right? And that's where I think part of what's happening is that the current court has softened in some pretty significant ways what it means to have an emergency, where, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there would be a real genuine, you know, outside the death penalty context, a real litigation emergency justifying emergency intervention from the Supreme Court, you know, maybe once a year. And now we're seeing it, you know, once a month, if not once a week. And that, you know, that to me is as much on the justices, Brian, as it is on the sort of the breakdowns elsewhere in government. Because if the justices are troubled by behavior of other institutional actors, if the justices think lower courts are being too aggressive in blocking executive branch policies, Brian, they can say so and they can do something about it. And instead, all we have are these, you know, up and down rulings with no rationale, where, just to take one example, you see lots of Trump era immigration policies that are blocked by lower courts and then unblocked through unsigned, unexplained rulings by the Supreme Court. But then when we get to Biden administration policies, similar policies that are blocked by lower courts, now the Supreme Court is not unblocking them. Right. So Danny is right that there are broader problems here that are explaining at least some of the phenomenon. My critique and what the book really tries to document is that that doesn't explain why the justices are acting inconsistently. It doesn't explain why the justices are not explaining themselves and providing guidance to lower courts and to government actors. And that's why this just looks so much worse, right? That's why it looks like partisan political behavior by the justices.
And so the other accusation in the title, that the court is using this stealth docket to amass power. Do you see the Supreme Court as in a competition with the Congress and the presidential branch over who has more say on things?
I mean, I think it's, if it's a competition with Congress, I think the, you know, Congress declared defeat a long time ago. And, you know, Brian, one of the stories that the book tries to tell, for especially for folks who are less well-versed in this history, is how this is actually a critical part of how the Supreme Court became so powerful, which is a, you know, 50-year-long back and forth between Congress and the court starting in the late 19th century about the court's docket, that is to say, which cases the court would hear, about the court's literal building, right? Until 1935, the Supreme Court actually sat in the Capitol, and getting it out of the Capitol was one of President and then Chief Justice Taft's, you know, big plans for making the court more autonomous. And so, Brian, I think the court has claimed a ton of power from Congress, both informally and formally, that we see today most directly in its docket, right? The court today, when it takes a case up on the merits, it is deciding in almost every case not just whether to hear the case or not, that is to say it has discretion over almost all of its docket, but even within the cases it's choosing to hear, the court has claimed the power to decide which questions it wants to decide within that case.
Yeah.
So just to take one example, the huge New York Second Amendment case from last term, Bruin, the court in that case was presented with two questions presented, right? So when you write a petition to the Supreme Court, the first page lists, you know, dear Supreme Court, here's what we want you to answer. And when the court granted review of that case, they rewrote the question presented. They said, you know, no, we're not going to grant the questions you want us to decide. We're going to grant your case to decide the question the way we have framed it.
So they gave even more expansive gun rights to people from out of state while they're in New York?
Exactly. And indeed, in a ruling that actually has ramifications far beyond New York. And so, I don't expect everyone to agree with each sort of jot and tittle of the critiques in the book. But I do think that once folks really come to appreciate how what we call certiorari, the discretionary power the court has over its docket, enables the court to basically pick and choose not just the cases it hears, but the questions it decides within the cases it hears, now we start to see part of the story of how the court has amassed all of this power. And Brian, how sort of Congress's acquiescence has led to a fairly fundamental breakdown in the court's accountability.
Would you say that word again? Because I'm never sure how to pronounce it when I come upon it. Certiorari?
So there's a debate among lawyers whether it's certiorari or certiorari, whether it's four syllables or five. That's why we just all abbreviate it to cert.
cert.
But the a writ of certiorari is the technical term basically for how the Supreme Court takes up most of its appeals. So if I, you know, if I lose a case in a federal court of appeals and I want the Supreme Court to hear the appeal, I file a petition for a writ of certiorari, basically saying, hey, Supreme Court, would you please take up my case? And it's entirely up to the justices whether or not to say yes. It takes four votes to say yes, although that's not written down anywhere. And the norm is that whatever the court decides with regard to taking up my case or not, it's not going to explain itself and it's not going to tell us what the vote count was.
Yeah. We just have a few minutes left. And I want to touch briefly on the three Supreme Court rulings that came out this morning. Notably, they were all unanimous. But a closing question about the ideas in the book and the Supreme Court amassing so much power, as you were just describing. What's your take on the right amount of Supreme Court power? I mean, we want checks and balances in our system. And I'm thinking of what's happening in Israel right now, where yep. the elected government is trying to weaken the court so the elected conservatives can have their way without that friction. So from a progressive or liberal perspective, there might be a tendency to root for a strong court in Israel and have rooted for a strong court when it granted abortion rights in the 1970s here or gay marriage rights in 2015, but to now say, oh, this court has too much power. So I'm asking, where's the single standard, ideally, in your opinion, for how much power this branch of government should have, regardless of what the politics of the current issues are?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where I'm a bit of an idiosyncratic centrist and institutionalist. Brian, I think the short answer is there's no bright line, but that the mantra ought to be what James Madison wrote in Federalist 51, that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. And so I want a strong court. I'm the rare progressive who thinks that even today we need a strong court, but a strong court is not an unaccountable court. And so, you know, Congress has tons of levers that historically it has pulled to keep the court in line and that it just has stopped pulling over the last 25, 30 years. Even though, Brian, if we look back across history, we've seen the Supreme Court be pretty strong for at least most of the post-Civil War era. So to me, right, these things are not in tension with each other nearly as much as defenders of the current court portray them to be. You can have a strong court that's also accountable to Congress, where Congress is preventing the court from getting too far out of kilter. You can have justices who have ambitions and agendas for where they want to take the court as an institution, as long as you have Congress as an institution pushing back. And I think the root of most of the evils with regard to our contemporary Supreme Court is not so much the identity of the justices on it, but the complete breakdown in Congress asserting any kind of institutional authority over the court in ways that basically leave it to whoever can control a majority of the court to go in whatever direction they want, to sort of dam the torpedoes full speed ahead.
So before you go, we are now entering that dramatic season, late spring through the end of June, when the momentous decisions of the current term get handed down every year. Three decisions this morning, and I see they're all unanimous. So not everything breaks down along ideological lines as much as we think.
Well, I mean, if I can spoil the punchline, though, Brian, one of those decisions only looks unanimous. The Clean Water Act case, Sackett versus EPA, is actually 5-4. It's unanimous that the Sacketts win, but it was actually 5-4 with Justice Kavanaugh joining the three Democratic appointees in sort of a much narrower ruling that actually would not have gutted the EPA's authority to regulate wetlands quite so much as Justice Alito's opinion for the majority does. So, you know, let's not get too optimistic about the court.
So wait, so the Supreme, is the real headline this morning, the Supreme Court gutted the EPA's authority to protect U.S. wetlands?
Certainly, gutted, I think, is my view, certainly at the very least dramatically limited. And in a context in which even Justice Kavanaugh took real issue with the analysis in Justice Alito's majority opinion.
Are the other two even worth mentioning?
Only to legal nerds. I think one of the things that we're seeing, Brian, is that the court is clearing out the cases that are of interest only to lawyers, and that we're in for a very, very busy June when it comes to the cases that are of much higher profile interest to the rest of us, whether it's affirmative action, the ability of private businesses to discriminate against same-sex couples, voting rights, you name it. It's going to be, you know, quite a 5 weeks at the Supreme Court. I think, though, the last thing I would just say is let's just not fall into the trap of thinking that the court is the sum total of these controversial and divisive merits rulings. They're obviously enormously important, but one of the real goals of the book is to persuade folks when they think about and when they talk about the Supreme Court to look at the rest of what the court is doing and not just the high-profile stuff that comes down in June.
And obviously, listeners will be on the high-profile stuff as it comes down in June. For today, we thank University of Texas Law Professor Stephen Vladeck, whose new book is called The Shadow Docket, How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. Thank you so much. Good talk.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.